good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us tonight Craig Roberts. Now, Craig is certainly one of my favorite guests. He is the author of at least 10 books, but we carry several of them. One is The Medusa File. Another is Killzone, A Sniper Look at Dealey Plaza, the story of the murder of President Kennedy. He was, of course, a police officer working at the Tulsa, Oklahoma Police Force when the bombing of the Murrah Building occurred back there in April of 1995. And because of his contacts with people, he was asked by the FBI to help them with their initial investigation, where they were sort of looking to try to find out what had really happened. That was before orders had come in from Washington, D.C., that there was not to be an investigation other than to find that Timothy McVeigh operated as the lone gunman. And, of course, only recently now has there been an effort to retry Terry Nichols. And what's really so interesting about this, although many of us knew that the FBI had not done a thorough investigation, and most of the really important issues that tied Terry Nichols into the Philippines and into Al-Qaeda and the Islamic terrorist movement had been suppressed at the trial. In fact, Stephen Jones, who's the defense lawyer for Timothy McVeigh, had said in his book, Others Unknown, the Oklahoma City Bombing Conspiracy, that was the second book, that he was not allowed to bring out any of the facts about Terry Nichols and the Al-Qaeda ties. Of course, now the FBI is saying, well, maybe we better look at it again, and maybe there are some right-wing militants who are really involved with Timothy McVeigh. Well, let's get Craig's view of this, because he's done a lot of extensive study, and of course he has more information than anybody I know about the Islamic terrorist tie-in to the bombing of the Murrah Building in April of 1995. Craig, thanks so much for being with us.
Always glad to be back, Dr. McKee.
Will you sort of pick up the story and you run with it? We'll just have to take a few little interruptions from time to time for commercials, but you go for it.
Well, basically, I was assigned to the case on day three through the chief's office in Tulsa, and I began working with the FBI the following week. With my assignment originally was to try to find out everything I could about McVeigh, his army background, and whether or not he'd made any contacts in Oklahoma, if he'd stayed any place, camped any place, attended any kind of meetings, and so on like that. So it was kind of an extensive deal, but what it did was it allowed me to go in many different directions. But the problem is, when you work an investigation, you can't just follow one path, because there's so many rabbit trails that take off in different directions. Every time you talk to somebody or interview somebody, they give you leads that go to some other direction, and you end up investigating more than just your original assignment. Because of this, I was able to talk to some of the people who were witnesses on day one of the bombing. Some of them were victims. Some of them were police in Oklahoma City at their end of the investigation, and we were able to, and even some news people that were working the case down there, and we were able to start piecing together what had happened on day one. Now, the time of the crime and the scene of the crime on day one of any type of investigation is the most important one, because that's when you have a chance to look at everything before the smoke clears, so to speak. Because if you wait too long, the next day, everything seems to get contaminated. Too many things fall through the crack. Witnesses all of a sudden begin to disappear, and so on.
Okay, just hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, I guess this evening, Craig Roberts, Craig, just pick up with the story.
And so on. By day two or day three, You know, if you haven't gathered all the major evidence you're going to get right then, from the initial witnesses to the scene and the initial evidence, then you're going to start losing ground on the thing, because the crime scene is going to change. It's going to become contaminated. The witnesses are going to drift away. They're going to change their stories and so on. So by day three, we had finally been able to piece together a scene of what had really happened. And I saw that the FBI was investigating areas that I didn't see anything in those areas that had anything to do with the case that we had, the evidence that we had. To give the listener some idea what we were dealing with, we had a situation on day one where McVeigh, as John Doe 1, was driving this Ryder truck. He stopped at Johnny's Tire Store in Oklahoma City. He had someone else in the cab with him. These are all just facts. He got out of the cab and he approached a man named Mike Moroz, who worked there, and asked him about directions to the Murrah building. And Moroz saw the other man in the cab of the truck, and later helped us helped the sketch artist do sketches of him as John Doe number 2, with a front and a side view, wearing a ball cap that was we found out later was a ball cap for the Dallas Cowboys football team, the blue star on the front. McVeigh gets back in the truck and he drives a few blocks south and then back to the east, and instead of pulling up in front of the Murrah building, he had to stop a block short, which was across the street from the post office on the south curb line on a one-way street headed east, because there was no parking places in front of the Murrah building. So he got out of the truck. We have eyewitnesses who saw him go to the rear of the truck while John Doe 2 was still sitting in a cab. McVeigh was on the curb talking to a short Arab with dark curly hair. At the same time, we have other witnesses who were entering the Murrah building who walked right past two Middle Eastern males wearing blue jogging suits, one on each side of the door, looking very stern and intimidating in their faces. And a UPS truck had pulled up to the front door and had stopped and was making a delivery. And other witnesses tell us that when the UPS truck left, then McVeigh got back in the Ryder truck, drove down the street one block, pulled into the area in front of the front door of the Murrah building, and he and John Doe 2 got out of the truck. John Doe 2, again described as a Middle Eastern male, muscular, military-looking, short, curly hair.
Just hold that thought for just a moment now, and we'll bring our last of our stations online here. All right, so John Doe 2 gets out. He's military-looking. Picked up the story from there.
And they both walk away from the Ryder truck, walking very quickly across the street north, where they got into the Yellow Mercury, backed up, turned around, and drove through the parking lot of the Journal Records building, which is the building north of the Murrah building.
Now, how far is that Mercury away where the truck, Ryder truck, was parked?
According to the witnesses, on the first 3 days, it was right across the street and had been and was sitting in the parking lot over there. And had been evidently spotted there or positioned there in advance, so that they didn't have very far to go. They only had to walk across the street, which is about a four-lane street, walk across the sidewalk into the parking lot, one or two parking places, and got in the car. And when they left that parking lot, they did it in haste and made a turn into the alleyway, pulling out of the parking lot, and almost ran over a guy there who was lighting his pipe, who worked at the Journal Records building. He looked in the cab or into the car, and he saw McVeigh and he saw John Doe 2, and he said they had looks at him like they had hate on their face, and they were definitely in a hurry. And when they made the turn, he's the one that spotted the license tag only hanging by one bolt, and he reported that it was an Arizona license tag. Well, as it turned out, it wasn't an Arizona license tag. That got translated incorrectly when it came out in the APB. We found out later on it was an Arkansas, which makes a lot more sense. It was an Arkansas tag, more than likely, because the tag was found behind the car after McVeigh was stopped by someone else and turned in. And it checked to a car that they had stolen it off of a car in Fort Smith, Arkansas, about 2 weeks before the bombing. We now have McVeigh. We've got John Doe 2, who later on was picked out of photographs and identified. And this information was turned over to the government. He was riding in the truck with McVeigh. We have since found out that there may have been a third person in the cab by the time it pulled up to the building. And instead of getting in the car, that it was the third person went down the sidewalk and got into a brown Chevrolet, brown GMC half-ton pickup truck with a bug shield on the front, very well described by the witnesses. And this is the same truck that the two Middle Eastern males standing in front of the front door with the two jogging suits got on and ran and jumped into, and they took off at a great deal of speed.
No, I can remember I was in an airport center at the time when the bombing, and I can remember those reports coming out, and they were looking for two Middle Eastern males and a brown pickup truck. So, and they were wearing jogging suits. That was the original report that went out, and that's how it stood at least for the first few hours. And then suddenly the official party line changes.
Well, when it really changed was about 2 days later. They raided. They find that they've got McVeigh in jail in Perry, Oklahoma. He'd been stopped leaving Oklahoma City. He was north of town, headed toward Kansas, and he was stopped by a trooper named Charlie Hanger for speeding. Charlie turned around and chased him, pulled him over, and when he got behind him, there was no license tag on the car, and everybody knows the rest of the story about it. He walked up, and McVeigh says, "I've got a gun in the car." So here's a guy that knows he just blew up who knows how many people. He's hearing the reports on the radio, and a trooper stops him, and he doesn't shoot the trooper. He just gives up. So this is my red flags are starting to go off at that point, along with several other areas as well. So they find out that McVeigh's in jail in Perry. They identify him as John Doe 1. Of course, he doesn't talk to anybody about anything. He won't identify anybody else. He says he's a prisoner of war, name, rank, and serial number, this sort of thing. And we have, at the same time, just right after this, they find out that he's linked up with a guy named Terry Nichols in Junction City, Kansas. So when they put the word out they're going to look for this Terry Nichols guy, Nichols turns himself into the local police department and says, "I think they want to talk to me, and I don't know why." And then later says, "Yeah, I know Tim McVeigh, but I don't have anything to do with anything." And then, of course, the rest of the story is when they raided his house, they found a drill bit, and the bit matched a lock that had been drilled open at a quarry where dynamite had been stolen and ammonium nitrate had been stolen and so on. And that's about the only evidence they had on Nichols, other than one note that McVeigh had that Nichols had signed that said, "Go for it." But the big thing that happened, and we've talked about this before, was the day after that, all of a sudden, we're looking for Arabs. We're looking for Arabs all over the place. And we're starting to develop some really good leads when all of a sudden the major news media comes out and starts attacking the right wing and attacking everything other than the direction we're going. They're going after militia and so on like this. McVeigh's ties to the militia and all of this nonsense. Well, this came out of the Janet Reno Justice Department, the Bill Clinton White House. And when I tried to find out how come ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN were all going in this direction when we had absolutely no evidence, no witnesses, no inclination to even look there, no reason to, why they were derailing the investigation in this manner. So I made a few calls to some of my media people that I know in New York, and they checked on, they got back to me, and they said, "Well, this is coming out of the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, a guy named Abraham Foxman. We've heard about him lately in the Passion for Christ movie. He's the one that's been raising all the cane about it being anti-Semitic and all of this. And also Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center and his Klan Watch and Militia Watch newsletters. What they were doing is they were using this tragedy in Oklahoma to their own personal advantage to attack their natural enemies, the conservatives, the right wing, the Republicans, Pat Robertson, Rush Limbaugh, whoever you want to name over there, and go after the militias and militia members and all this stuff who were totally not in the picture. We knew this up front. But the FBI was directed out of Washington to begin working that angle, and that they were told there is no Middle Eastern connection, period, so don't even look there.
Well, Craig, certainly when Timothy McVeigh was captured or was apprehended, he was wearing some sort of a patriotic T-shirt. He had a copy of the Turner Diaries in his car. He's got all sorts of right-wing material, almost like he was trying to appear to be associated with the militia. In other words, he was almost like, as you've said before, building a legend, having all of this information there. I mean, suppose he's committed one of the worst crimes of all time. He's killed 168 people, and he's got all this evidence that sort of equates him with the right wing, almost like somebody was scripted what was going to happen.
Well, you know, when we say he was sheep-dipped, when you remember my original assignment was try to find out what he could about him being in the Army, and when I got a hold of the provost marshal's office at Fort Riley, Kansas, they said that he'd gone to that he was AWOL, that he'd gone to Fort Bragg and never come back, and he'd gone there to get into special forces. When I got a hold of Fort Bragg, depending on what day of the week it was, you got a different reason as to why he wasn't there anymore. And one of them was they sent him back to Fort Riley. His back hurt, his foot hurt, he didn't pass the PT test, he didn't pass the psychological test, whatever. You know, every time you called, you got a different reason. And the bottom line was he disappears and does not get a dishonorable discharge. He doesn't get a general or undesirable discharge. He just disappears. And no one seems to have stamped him gone.
No, I think that probably the one thing that our listeners really need to know is what Stephen Jones, the attorney, brings out in his book, the OKC bombing, others unknown, the Oklahoma City bombing. And that was that Timothy McVeigh had written to his sister Jennifer and said, I am a member of a special forces team involved in illegal activity. And when Stephen Jones opened his defense in Colorado, that was the first thing he brought out. The media never mentioned it. The prosecution never mentioned it. It was almost as if the statement had never been made. And I dare say that there are very, very few Americans who have ever even suggested or been allowed to think that Timothy McVeigh may have been just what he says he was, part of a special forces organization involved in illegal activity, because you pointed out on another interview that he was actually went to work for a government facility that required, at least a facility that required a top secret clearance. There's no way somebody was AWOL from the Army could have gotten that job, is there?
Right. He ends up not only disappearing from the Army, he ends up employed as a security guard in the security division of Calspan Incorporated up in Buffalo, New York, which is his hometown. And he gets this job, supposedly AWOL from the Army, yet he passes a total background check and gets a secret or top secret clearance. So he works there for a while, and everything's fine, and he's doing a good job, and there's no problems, till one day he shows up, and he starts spouting all his anti-government rhetoric, and he starts passing out copies of the Turner Diaries, and anybody that's ever seen, it's a little pamphlet-looking book, but if you ever read that thing, it's just totally inflammatory. And it's pretty obvious that, you know, somebody that would read this and think it was good really far off the edge of the Flat Earth Society. But he starts doing this. So what he's really doing is he's doing exactly the same thing that Lee Harvey Oswald did when he in New Orleans when he was passing out Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets and picking fights with the anti-Castro Cubans. He was building a legend so that he could be identified as a Marxist or a communist. Well, here's McVeigh building a legend so that he could be identified as a right-wing, extreme, radical, anti-government, whatever. And then he leaves Calspan Incorporated. He bums around the country. He shows up at a few gun shows. He goes to a few militia meetings and gets thrown out because he's so loud-mouthed and radical. They don't want anything to do with this guy. They think he's a nut. He shows up down at Waco. Hangs out down there during the siege, and then he ends up going out to Kingman, Arizona, and trying to get in with different people who were along that bent in that area as well, with the 40As and some of the other people. And they go out in the desert and they blow up things and they shoot guns and so on.
But he has no visible means of support. He always seems to have money, and yet no visible means of support.
Right. He's got an old car, but he always can stay in motels and buy food at restaurants, and has no job.
And then supposedly he's involved in a robbery, as our Terry Nichols is involved in the robbery. That's the explanation the government gives for where he got his money. We'll be back in just a moment with Craig Roberts. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Craig, pick up the story from there.
So we've got all of this going on with McVeigh, but at the same time, Nichols isn't staying home either. He's making several trips overseas, but he's not bumming around the country going high profile. He's staying as low profile as possible. And what we find out later, and what Stephen Jones and his investigators find out during their investigation, is that Nichols has made several trips to the Philippines since about 1992, and he had gone to Davao City, he'd gone to Manila, he'd been to Cebu City. In fact, at one time, he lived in the Philippines for 6 months. He had had a divorce from his wife, Lana Padilla, and he had gone through, now this is the story, he had gone through a mail-order bride service out of Scottsdale, Arizona, and they had fixed him up with a gal in the Philippines named Mary Faye Torres, and he goes over there to meet her. We start digging into it a little bit more, and we find out that this Philippines dating service was a front company that disappeared right after all of this happened, and that the guy he traveled over with ended up being his escort. His name was Lepke, and he had escorted him over there, and they had he introduced him to several people over there that were very unsavory. They had several meetings, and a lot of these meetings occurred with a group known as the Abu Sayyaf. Now, Abu Sayyaf is the Philippine Muslim or Islamic extremist anti-government terrorist group, supported by funding from the Middle East, by funding from Afghanistan and Pakistan, especially Bukistan area, the Bukistani area of Pakistan, which is right on the Fort Sherman border area near the Khyber Pass, where the old Mujahideen training camps were. We left over 100 training camps for the Mujahideen when we pulled out after the Afghani-Soviet war, and they were all given to the Mujahideen, which the Mujahideen really is basically a loosely grouped cluster of different tribes that sometimes get along, sometimes don't. There's no central Mujahideen tribe. That's just a group or a warrior group. And what they did is they connected with the ISI, which is the Pakistani Internal Security Institute, their version of the CIA, and the ISI took over the old CIA training camps along with the Mujahideen, and they began training terrorists. So you got the Pakistani government on one side, the Mujahideen on the other, and they're both working together to train Islamic terrorists to fight any place against any non-Islamic types that they're mad at the time, and specifically the great Satan, which is us, and Israel, and Britain, and France, and Germany. So all of these camps are in full operation, within a year or two after we leave, and they stay in operation up until almost today. So Lepke goes over there with them. He meets with Abu Sayyaf. Now, here's Terry Nichols. And let's talk about who he met with at these meetings.
Now, this is in the Philippines.
The Philippines. He meets with a guy named Edwin Angeles. Now, Edwin Angeles is the second command of the Abu Sayyaf. But Edwin is also a Philippine government agent, and he was one of them who he was spying on everything that was going on and reporting everything that was going on inside of Abu Sayyaf, but at the same time he was facilitating Abu Sayyaf doing things so they wouldn't suspect him, such as planting bombs or ambushes or kidnapping and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. He also, in this meeting, is a guy named of Abdul Hakim Murad and Muhammad Wali Khan, which is also known as Wali Khan Aman Shah.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Craig. All right, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest is Craig Roberts. He's talking about Terry Nichols, his trips to the Philippines, where he's getting the money to go to the Philippines, we don't know, but he makes not one but a series of trips over there, and at least on one of the trips he is meeting with a man named Edward Angeles, who is of course a infiltrator of Abu Sayyaf. He was the number two man in that Abu Sayyaf, which is the Islamic terrorist movement, only is really a Philippines government spy. In fact, the Philippine government helped to organize the terrorist movement. A man named Murad, who is a member of Al-Qaeda. A man named Wali Khan. Who is Wali Khan, and who else was there?
Well, you have Muhammad Wali Khan. You have another guy in one of the reports that was simply named Zachariah. We think that may have been Zakariya Moussaoui, who was later, you know, caught here in the United States and held as a member of Al-Qaeda, that he was the one that missed the plane that went to the World Trade Center. Another guy named, they named him in the Philippine intelligence reports as Abdul Basit. But who he was, actually, was Abdul Basit Mahmoud Abdul Karim, and his real name, that's his real name, but the name that we caught him by later was Ramzi Ahmed Yosef. So, Ramzi Yosef.
Now, for our listeners, Ramzi Yosef was the man who was responsible for the first World Trade Center bombing. So,
in 1993.
Right, and so this is 1994 when these meetings are being held over in the Philippines, and here's Terry Nichols cavorting with the master bomb builder.
Well, and you've got Yosef at that time was working on a project known as Operation Bojinka. And Operation Bojinka was a deal where the Al-Qaeda was paying him to blow up a dozen American jumbo jets, 12 American jumbo jets. And he was building bombs to do this, but because of his association with Abu Sayyaf, the Philippine police were able to arrest him before he succeeded in his mission. He did put some bombs aboard some of the airplanes, but they were discovered and they did not go off. Otherwise, you know, of course, we would have known about it. So they arrested him, and they arrested him, they captured his laptop computer, and his laptop computer hard drive had all kinds of information that eventually got back to us and so on.
Now this is Murad that they caught at that time. They caught Murad, and Ramzi Yosef escaped to the Philippines, was caught there a few months later.
Right. Ramzi Yosef was caught in Pakistan.
Right.
And brought back, but they got Ramzi's computer. Is what happened.
Right.
There was an apartment fire, I think it was, and they ended up, he got away, but they got his computer.
Now, what about this fellow, Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is an interesting character. He was born, actually, he was the mastermind of Operation Bojinka. And also the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings, and he was also credited as being the mastermind behind our September 11th terrorist attacks in New York City.
Was he over there at the time when Terry Nichols was?
Yes, they met with him at these meetings. And he was also in the Bali nightclub bombings that happened over in Indonesia, and he tried to bomb American Airlines Flight 63, and he was involved in the murder of Daniel Pearl and other Al-Qaeda attacks. He's got about a dozen aliases that he goes by, and he's just right to the right hand of Osama bin Laden himself. In fact, two of his aliases are Osama something or other. So that shows you he's showing great respect to Osama bin Laden. He was in the Philippines in 1994, 1995, and when he was there, he said he was a Saudi, and then later on, he said he was a Qatari, and then later on, he went by the name of Abdul Majid, and this guy was not a very good Muslim. He was well known over there to be a real partier. He chased women, he drank alcohol, he went to karaoke clubs, always held meetings in the most expensive hotels, left large tips, spent a lot of money, real high roller, always carried a big roll of money with him. In fact, he even got infatuated with one girl over in the Philippines, and he rented a helicopter to buzz her house just to impress her. I mean, this guy was a real playboy.
But of course, I think the significant thing is that Terry Nichols is meeting with all of these Islamic terrorists, and Edward Angeles is reporting all of this, and this is well known. But of course, and Stephen Jones covered a great deal of this when he investigated this. Is Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney. But none of this could be brought out at the trial. The judge refused to allow any of this to be brought out because the last thing that they wanted was the American people to realize that there was a direct tie between the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 and a fellow named Osama bin Laden. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Craig Roberts. And please hold your calls. I don't want to take any calls for the time being. I want you to get this whole story.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Craig Roberts, who was a police officer with the Tulsa, Oklahoma Police Department, who was assigned to the FBI to work on the Oklahoma City bombing. So he has been, of course, involved with this investigation to a greater or lesser degree ever since then, and especially recently with Terry Nichols coming back to be tried. But right now, of course, we've been covering the fact that Terry Nichols was known to have been in the Philippines. It was known that he was meeting with these Islamic terrorists tied to Al-Qaeda, and of course the Sheikh Mohammed was right-hand man for Osama bin Laden. This was all known back in 1995, plus the fact that there was a plan to blow up or to hijack our planes. This was known as Operation Bajinka, and to crash them into the World Trade Center, White House, the Pentagon, the Sears Building in Chicago, and the Transamerica Building in San Francisco. And anybody would like, we have an article that was written by Bill Gertz, 2 months of the Washington Times, 2 months actually before the September 11th attack was written in July of the year 2001, telling you just what I've told you. Oh, the only trouble is that Bill Gertz now denies that he ever wrote the article. It's the most amazing thing. And when he wrote his book recently and published it, he left that story completely out, other than the fact that Operation Bajinka did involve hijacking planes and crashing into the CIA building. But I guess he'd forgotten that 2 months before the attack, he'd written about also involving the World Trade Center, and I believe it was the White House. Go ahead. Oh, the Pentagon, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Craig.
Well, let's jump back to Wali Khan Amin Shah. Shah's an Afghan who fought with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion, and after that he went to the Manila, where he laundered money through several individuals to come up with the money for Project Bojinka. And what's interesting is the Bojinka plot, Khan bombed himself. He set the bombs in the Greenbelt Theater in Manila on December the 1st of 1994. The Bojinka plot was foiled on January the 6th, 1995. Khan was arrested by Manila police at that apartment on Singalong Street that we talked about, where they got the hard drive and the computer on January the 11th of 1995, but he escaped 77 hours later. They gave him a false passport with the name Osama Turkestani on it, which is so bogus it's incredible that anybody would even believe that was a name. And ended up making his way to Malaysia, where he was arrested in December a year later.
Hold that thought just one moment, and all right, go right ahead, Craig. And so we're just sort of chronicling, of course, Terry Nichols' contacts with Islamic radicals. Now, you'll never read anything about this in any of the controlled press and the media. The government knows all of this. The FBI knows all of this. But none of this is allowed to be brought out, because maybe the American people might understand that there was a tie-in between the Oklahoma City bombing and the Islamic radicals and Osama bin Laden. And maybe if we'd done something back then, we wouldn't have had a September 11th.
Well, and what's interesting here is we go back and we look and we see that Shah was arrested, or the plot was foiled on Bojinka in January the 6th of 95. You've got Yosef, who is arrested in Pakistan in February of 95. And then in April the 15th, we've got the Oklahoma City bomb, or April 19th, we have the Oklahoma City bombing that goes off.
Right.
So, you got a 90-day period where Bojinka fails, two of these three guys get arrested, and then all of a sudden the Oklahoma City bombing. Just previous to this, Nichols had been in the Philippines. So, meeting with these same guys. Now, I've got, right now, I'm looking at a report that came out of the Philippines, and it's from an informant there, and it says right here, later in 1991, December 17th, we're able to meet with Abdul Hakim Murad, Wali Khan, and a certain Abdul Basit, which is Ramzi Yosef, which I later became known to be Ahmed Yosef. Through a certain Zachariah in Davao City, Terry Nichols was introduced together with John Lepney. We talked about organizational alliance by helping the Arabs to procure firearms from Cebu and Manila and explosive chemicals at that time. After our meeting, the three Arabs were escorted by Edwin Angeles to Basilan province to see the Abu Sayyaf group leader. After our meeting with the Abu Sayyaf group leader, we went to Zambo City to meet a certain Bob, a U.S. citizen, and they talked about granite tilling for making steel in Zamboanga del Sur. Bob was later known as a close friend of a certain congressman, Jalos Jos, who's Philippine. He says, and both Jalos Jos and Major Loriente were directly involved with granite tilling. And it goes on from there about other things. So it's an entire intelligence report, but here it puts Terry Nichols' meeting with these guys at that particular time, December 17th of 1991. So this, you know,
This is December 1994.
Well, this is 91 right
here. This is 91, okay.
This is 91. Well, this is before the World Trade Center bombing.
Okay, fine.
And of course, we've got Ramzi Yosef still, you know, running around down there at that time, planning on that part. So all of these things are going on. So let's jump back to Oklahoma City for a minute, because we've got Janet Davis there, who by this time, I'm working more with her and David Hoffman and Jimmy Rothstein and several of the others down there, that we've sort of formed a loose coalition of truth seekers, because we're wanting to get to the truth, and the FBI's been derailed on this thing. They brought in another team to take over all the actual investigation at the scene, which really means they're not investigating anything. They're really intimidating witnesses and destroying the evidence.
No, I think for our listeners, Jana Davis was the investigative reporter for Channel 4 there. Then somebody comes in and buys up Channel 4, takes her off the case. But she is persistent. She wants to find out who John Doe 2 and John Doe 3 and John Doe 4 are. And she pretty well tracks down and identifies these other Arabs or Iraqis who were involved with Timothy McVeigh, didn't she?
Right. We found out. She didn't know where they came from. She found out that there was a PLO guy living in Oklahoma City who owned several rental properties, and that he had employed some Iraqis most of them couldn't even speak English, to work for him restoring or renovating these rental properties. And when we found out who this guy was, she came to me and she wanted me to try to find out who he was. And so I started looking at him and pulled some police records on him. It turned out he was a convicted felon. He'd been to prison for insurance fraud. What he did at the time, his M.O. was to buy these HUD homes that were all dilapidated. Then he would go in and paint them up a little bit, fix them up a little bit, try to rent them out. And if he couldn't rent them out or couldn't make any money on them, he would burn them and then, you know, claim that they burnt down and claim the insurance money. Well, then he would take the insurance money and he would bag it to Jerusalem. He held an Israeli passport. He could go to Jerusalem with the money and give it to the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. So he was supporting terrorism, according to the police reports. So he has 12 Iraqis working for him. This guy is a Jordanian, but he's got these Iraqis working for him. And we started checking on those guys, and what they were part of 3,500 Iraqis who were brought over to this country, who were POWs that we held as prisoners of war after the fall of Kuwait during the Gulf War. And this one particular one that they identified as being in the cab with McVeigh as John Doe 2 was an Iraqi Republican Guard officer. He was a lieutenant, and he was part of the same group that was blowing up all the oil wells over in Kuwait when we saw all the oil fires going off over there. So he knew how to use explosives. And here he is in the truck with McVeigh.
But, of course, the government has done everything they could to prove that this isn't so.
Well, what they do is if they can't discredit or debunk it, they ignore it. And so we got no press other than Channel 4 until they were bought by the media out of New York City, bought them and fired Jana Davis. We got no play in the local newspapers. Their deal was if it's not Nichols and McVeigh, then you don't know what you're talking about. You're a nutcase. And one of the worst newspapers in Oklahoma was the Tulsa World. I tried to give them information. They had a reporter assigned to the case, and I tried to say, look what we're finding out here. This is, I'll give you a scoop on this. This is a great news story. I'll give you copies of my reports. And could not get past their editors. And when Charles Key tried to give them some information, their cartoonist, the political cartoonist there, started painting cartoons of him as the Mad Hatter and Alice in Wonderland and a nutcase and all kinds of stuff like that.
And Charles Key was a member of the legislature there, and he was trying to get to the bottom of it, and everything was done to discredit him. In fact, anyone who tried to bring out the truth of what happened was demonized and marginalized and laughed at and ridiculed. And after all, I mean, you're suggesting there is a conspiracy behind the bombing of the Oklahoma City building.
Yeah, they were all following and rubber stamping the government lead out of the Janet Reno Justice Department and Louis Freeh FBI that there is no Middle Eastern connection. Now, this really bothered me because we knew we had it. We knew who they were. We couldn't get anybody to do anything about it. You know, as one cop out here with a pair of handcuffs, I can't go arrest an entire gang of terrorists. You know, you need a lot more help than that, and you got to have a U.S. prosecutor that's going to take the case, and you got to have a judge that's going to hear the case. And if you can't get past that, those two roadblocks, it doesn't do any good to go out and try to arrest anybody. So, you know, there's myself and two or three policemen in Oklahoma City who were doing everything we could to try to ring the bell on this, and we couldn't get anybody's attention. So I started wondering, okay, why doesn't Washington want to get the bad guys? You know, Clinton could really come out smelling like a hero on this. And of course, I couldn't stand that guy, but if he said, my FBI went out and they caught these guys and they're Arab terrorists and we've got them, by gosh, and we're going to go, you know, launch a missile on their home base or something, you know, that this probably would have played well. The problem is they didn't go that direction. It didn't make any sense until I received a phone call. And a phone call came from a friend of a friend who's a Texas state policeman. And he told me that he had contacts in Texas. So through his informants down on the border, that there was a guy in Texas, a guy named Juan Garcia Abrego in Texas, who was a Mexican drug lieutenant in the cocaine running field, who had sent two bagmen to Oklahoma City to help finance the bombing. And we had received information that two Mexicans showed up in Oklahoma City dressed up like Arabs and stayed in a hotel one night. And we didn't think that there was anything to that. We didn't know there was any connection, and we kind of laughed it off at the time. But here it's a month later, and I'm getting this information that this guy named Juan Garcia Abrego had sent these guys up. Well, I started checking on this Abrego guy, and my FBI people told me he didn't exist. No such character. They ran him in the computer. Doesn't exist. It's all hokum. That was the word they used. And a year later, I find out that he gets arrested by the FBI, and he's extradited, you know, out of Mexico to Houston, Texas, and they're taking him off an airplane, and I watch it on TV. That was on a Friday. On Monday, I'm on my way to work, and I stop at the post office. I look up, and here he is on a wanted poster hanging on the wall at the post office. So I took the poster, and I went back to the FBI office, and I walked in. I said, you remember the memos I sent you last year on a guy named Juan Garcia Abrego? And they said, yeah. And they said, you told me he didn't exist. It's all hope. And they said, yeah. I said, well, that's funny, because here's his wanted poster. Your company got him over the weekend, brought him out of Mexico, extradited him, and he's a massive cocaine smuggler, and has been around for a long time. And of course, they had egg on their face, and I didn't want to talk about it anymore. But what I did is I did a little more checking on that, and come to find out, he was part of the Iran-Contra smuggling ring of the cocaine that was coming out of Colombia, out of Bogota, Colombia, from the Medina and Cali cartels, was coming to Panama, where Noriega, of course, was intercepting his share. And then it was going from there to Honduras and Costa Rica, and then from there to El Salvador, to Ilopango Air Base, where it was flown by Southern Air Transport and some of the other companies, up to Los Angeles and up to a place called Mena, Arkansas. Interestingly, at that same time, Bill Clinton is governor of Mena, or of Arkansas. And Mena was operating right under his nose. And if you go by what Terry Reid says, Clinton knew exactly what was going on down there.
But
so now we've got the ground route that wasn't being flown coming through Juan Garcia Abrego in Brownsville, Texas. So now we've got Abrego, whose name pops up as helping finance the Oklahoma City bombing. So what does that have to do with anything? Well, there's one little piece of the puzzle that was missing. But that piece of the puzzle came in a phone call. A guy called my office to talk to me, and he said that he was a federal agent in Little Rock, Arkansas. Little Rock, Arkansas. He did not work for the FBI. He did not work for the DEA. And so that basically left the IRS and I'm sorry, he didn't work for the FBI and he didn't work for the CIA. That left the DEA and the IRS, is the only ones I could think of, because he said that their investigative reports of the Clintons and the Rose Law Firm and all of the Iran-Contra connections in Arkansas that they were looking at back during Iran-Contra had been taken out of Arkansas when the Clintons went to Washington, and they were secreted in the Murrah Building. They were hidden in the Murrah Building for safekeeping until there was a congressional investigation. Okay, so let's just throw that in the mix. Now we find out there's going to be a congressional investigation in May of 1995 of the MENA end of Iran-Contra with the Clinton involvement. There's also going to be an investigation of Ruby Ridge, and there's also going to be a congressional investigation of Waco. Well, after the bombing, we have Ruby Ridge investigation occurred, Waco investigation occurred, nothing occurred on MENA. Nothing occurred on the Iran-Contra stuff. Now, let's go back to day one. The key thing that happened on day one that stuck in my mind was the fact that they stopped rescuing people within an hour and a half of the blast. They got everybody back away from the building. They brought in a team of about 50 guys with Blu-ray jackets on, backed up a couple of box ambulances, and they carried out files. And these files were taken out of the building, loaded on these ambulances, and when they got all the paper that they needed, they took off and no one ever saw them again. Then everybody was allowed to go back to the building and start rescuing. Now, what paper would be so important that you would leave people dying, trapped in rubble? And the reason we know this happened is because there was a fireman who was up on the sixth floor who did not evacuate the building when they said to, and he watched this whole thing happen. He's the one that reported that they also came out with a stretcher that had a missile on it, and they put it in there. We later found out it was probably the Marines' inert tow missile that was in the recruiting office up there. But the fact still remains, they stopped the entire rescue effort to rescue boxes of documents. So let's put that all together. We got the FBI denying that Juan Garcia Abrego exists when, in fact, he was on their 10 most wanted list at the exact time I asked them and wrote the memos inquiring who this guy was. We get a Texas State policeman who says, hey, my informants tell me that this guy sent two Mexican bagmen up to Oklahoma City to help finance the bombing. We find out that there's this guy is involved in Iran-Contra and cocaine smuggling on the ground route at the same time that Clinton and all of his bunch was, governor of Arkansas when MENA was heavily involved in this, and Arkansas state policemen were actually guarding the airport to make sure these guys weren't disturbed. We find out that we get a call from somebody just right out of the blue who sounded like he knew he was talking about, that wanted to give us free information, that the records in the Murrah Building were the key to the whole thing. We find out that on day one, they quit rescuing everybody to rescue papers out of the Murrah Building. We find out that the investigation for MENA did not occur when it was supposed to, which was going to be May of 1995. So why Oklahoma City, of all the buildings in the country, why pick the Murrah Building? I didn't even know the place existed until after the bombing went off. How would McVeigh know? How would all these Arabs know? Now let's go back to the Arabs. We got the Iraqis. Where'd they come from? 3,500 Iraqi POWs brought over here illegally by Madeleine Albright's State Department. They were smuggled in through Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, and were scattered all over the country where they formed 10- and 12-man cells, specifically in Boston, New York, and the Bronx, and in Brooklyn, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Dade County, Florida, New Orleans, Dallas-Fort Worth area has several, Oklahoma City has two cells, Tulsa has one, Kansas City, Denver, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and several other cities. So these guys are scattered everywhere. We have right now an entire Iraqi terrorist organization operating in this country that were brought in by our own government, and we didn't find out about it until the VFW and the American Legion discovered it and said, hey, wait a minute, you got money to bring these guys in here who fought against us. You're the same government who left our POWs behind in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and you're the same government who doesn't have enough money to fund our VA hospitals, and yet you can give these guys money and put them up in apartments and buy them groceries and put them on the payroll. What's the deal? And that's how the cat got out of the bag on that just before the Oklahoma City bombing. So why did we bring them over here? I don't know. I think that's a question we need to be asking, because they didn't stop bringing them over. There was over 5,000 last count that they had brought over within a year of the Oklahoma City bombing. So there was 1,500 more that were brought over after the initial 35 to 3,600 that we know about.
Well, there are a lot of imponderables out there, a lot of unanswered questions, but there is one thing that's very definite, and that is there was a very definite tie-in between the Oklahoma City bombing and, of course, Osama bin Laden. But, of course, the American people knew that, and they knew that we had specifically covered up that fact, just like we covered up the truth about the downing of TW-800, covered up the fact that we knew that these Islamic terrorist cells were operating here. That's all covered beautifully in a film called Jihad in America. By Stephen Emerson, the government or somebody suppressed that film when it was shown one time in 1994. Our film is available at WorldNet Daily. You need to see it, knowing back in 1988, the Islamic radicals were here talking about jihad in America and blood flowing in the streets. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Craig Roberts to wrap up this incredible story here at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest this evening is Craig Roberts, and of course he's giving us more or less an overview of what he was able to determine as far as the background of the Oklahoma City bombing. We've got about 2.5 minutes to wrap up the incredible story, Craig.
Well, I think that what we're seeing again is a replay of diversion right now, because of the Nichols trial. They're saying, well, there might be some other people involved, but it'll probably be down through Elohim City, and it'll probably be these Aryan nation bank robber guys and all of this nonsense. All of those were diversions back in 1995 and 1996, and they're still diversions today. They still don't want to bring in the Middle Eastern connection, even though we've had a change of regimes, which the only thing that I can put there is that the current president's father was also vice president during Iran-Contra and was probably as involved as anybody else was at the top end of the Iran-Contra scandal. So he's protecting his dad. I don't know. It's just an opinion. It's a hunch. It's one of those things investigators get. And I think that if we went there, we'd turn over some rocks and find some very interesting revelations.
But don't you think the CIA is definitely involved in this whole thing? I don't think this could be pulled off without CIA involvement. And remember, George Herbert Walker Bush was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, it was the CIA that set up the Mujahideen, it was the CIA that trained them all, turned the camps over to the ISI, and we know that the CIA ran drugs during Iran-Contra, they ran drugs in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, they ran drugs out of Iran when they were supporting the Shah, and it goes on and on. It's the same cells, the same names. When I wrote the book, The Medusa File, we kept seeing the same names over and over crop up through history, and it can only lead to one conclusion. There is a conspiracy, and it's the same people that are involved.
Craig, do you have a website at all?
www.riflewarrior.com.
www.riflewarrior.com. And, of course, Craig has written the book, The Medusa File, which we carry. He's written the book, Kill Zone, which we carry. And then, of course, there's another book, the one on Somalia. What's the title of that, written by a friend of yours?
Doorway to Hell, Disaster in Somalia.
And that was a very, very important book. And, of course, it was written by a general who has gotten the material of what really happened in Somalia. Well, Craig, I want to thank you so much for being with us and telling this story. And I'm sure that there may be people out there who've never heard these things before. And probably this is a little over their head. And yet, of course, I don't think there's any question at all that we've not gotten the truth about what really happened there at the Oklahoma City bombing.
Well, thanks for having me back, Doc, and God bless.
God bless you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to just have to wrap up this program here in just about a minute or two, and, of course, we'll tell you about some of the items that we have that will help you better to understand this incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we have a number of fascinating interviews on the Oklahoma City bombing. We have the Oklahoma City bombing 4-tape set. We have the Oklahoma City bombing update 4-tape set with a lot of interviews you won't hear any other place. The interview with Carol Howe's attorney. She was a woman came from a very wealthy family who infiltrated the Elohim City at the behest of the BATF, risked her life because she thought she was being patriotic, and then the government decided they were going to send her to prison probably for the rest of her life. And had it not been for the fact that her family was well-to-do and hired an excellent attorney, Clark Brewster, to defend her, why she'd be rotting in prison today. What was her crime? Well, of course, she was told in Elohim City by some of the people there that there was a plan to blow up the Murrah building, and she'd told her superiors there, she'd told the people in the BATF, and they couldn't allow that information to come out at the McVeigh trial. So you'll actually hear my interview with Clark Brewster, and that, of course, is in the Oklahoma City bombing update. There's a fourth. There's a video called A Cover-Up in Oklahoma City, and it's simply the film footage that was shot in Oklahoma City on the day of the bombing, the day after the bombing. You'll hear them talk about the second and third bombs that they have and how wonderful it is. They've got all these other bombs from inside the building because now they're going to be able to find out who really built these bombs. Incredible footage that was never shown throughout the rest of the country. How could you block that out? Very simply, you control the mass media. And then, of course, you've got somebody like Jaina Davis, worked for Channel 4, that's really going to get to the bottom of the story. You just go down and you buy up the television station. That's exactly what happened. And, of course, then the further investigation was discontinued. Could these things happen in America? There are many things that can happen in America. When a nation has turned its back on God, we have the wicked people take control of the government and the reins of power and the media, and this is what's going on in what was once a great Christian nation. So our plea is, if you'd like to know more about what's going on, we'd be glad to send you one of our catalogs. If you'd like my copy of my February newsletter tells you what really happened on September 11th in the Presidential Emergency Operating Center, the basement of the White House, a bunker down beneath the White House, as they tracked the plane coming in that was going to hit the Pentagon. And of course, this comes from the testimony given by Norman Mineta on the 23rd of May of last year before the 911 Commission, and totally blocked out by the media. But we have the testimony, and we can tell you where you can get copies of it. Fascinating to see what happened when they knew the plane was coming in. And how they reacted to the fact that the plane was about to hit the Pentagon. Well, there's so much information that the average American has never been told, and this is why I do what I do 5 hours a day. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can hear our programs on shortwave 4 hours a day at 5.745 megahertz. If you call and ask for a copy of our February newsletter, we'll send you a catalog. You know the stations that we're on, about 60 outlets every single week, as we try to bring the American people the truth. Because, you see, we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you really should. But give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope many of you will want to get the video Diaprax, which goes into the church growth movement, Megiddo, which is the story of the march to Armageddon, and the Third World War, which we're already involved in, Iraq, the untold story, going into the fact that all of the wars of the last century were contrived. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident. Adolf Hitler was financed by American corporations, creating the best enemy that money could buy. And then, of course, we hope that you'll pray for America, that you'll pray for revival, you'll pray for our leaders and our ministers, and lastly, of course, that you remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle 5 hours a day. So until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, this is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line right now Aaron Traylor. We're going to be talking about his book, A Life Remixed. Aaron, are you there?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
It's good to have you with us tonight, and I just finished reading your book and really enjoyed it.
Phenomenal. Thank you very much.
Well, of course, Aaron is the son of Ellen Gunderson Traylor, who's a frequent guest on our programs, who writes the most wonderful biblical stories, or biblical-based stories, and we carry all of Ellen's books, but she told me about a book that had been written by her son, and of course it goes into his experiences as a disc jockey, a young man growing up in the Spokane area, and of course I can sort of identify with you. How tall are you?
I'm 6'10".
And you're 6'10". Well, I was about 6'6¾", and I was always the biggest and gainiest kid in my area. Of course, I was about 2 years ahead of all the other kids, and so I was really underdeveloped. And I guess, in many respects, I could identify with you because I felt very much like you do. I wasn't quite 6'10", but I was a pretty tall, and people expect you're going to be tremendously well-coordinated and a great athlete, but I didn't fit into that category. It doesn't sound like you did either.
Oh, it was really difficult to fit in, especially in junior high school, because that's the time when your body's developing the most, and you're really not exactly sure what you are or who you're going to become, and people will ridicule others, especially the ones who seem to be a little more athletic. They look at me thinking I should be, you know, right alongside of them, when in reality I was all about acting and all about music when I was much younger.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you start out, you tell your book, and you're sort of living by yourself now. You're living, I guess, in the Spokane area, and you're just trying to find where you fit in, and you go to this rave dance, and you're really just sort of overcome by the music and by the excitement of this. And why don't you sort of start telling the story, how it was that you began preparing yourself to become a disc jockey?
Every generation has their own version of an underground scene. There were many jazz lovers who had to go into dark alleyways to try and find locations that catered to their musical needs. I happened to be invited to an event that not very many of them had come around at that time. They were called raves, and they were all-night dance parties that went on until 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was just, instead of a band, there would be a disc jockey, and the disc jockey would just manipulate sound with turntables, and I would sit back and just be blown away by just a one-man performance each and every time I went to these events. And I'd sometimes get up and dance, and when I did dance, I would just lose myself in the message that he'd bring across with sometimes these instrumental tracks known as techno. And from that point on, I think I knew what I wanted to become. I was into acting heavily, but I realized that if I was ever going to be able to make it on my own and pay my own bills, I'd have to relinquish the name Starving Artist and move into something that would kind of tap into acting and my love for music, and DJing just did it for me. But I realized that there was more to it than that. In order to be a well-rounded DJ, you have to be well-versed in playing music at live environments and behind a microphone. Being an announcer, such as yourself, Dr. Stan, you have to kind of find all ways of being a disc jockey in order to make it a full-time job, and I happened to do it, and I went through the process of moving up the ranks, and along the way gained popularity, gained fame, gained who I thought were friends along the way, but when that title is stricken from you, they take it away, and because of one thing or another, you're kind of left with nothing, and with that, you began a downward spiral, which was, is what the book talks about more than anything.
And, of course, really you had gotten to be the most popular, one of the most popular disc jockeys in the Spokane area. And you, of course, were the fellow who was playing the programs, the songs at nighttime, and talking to the people. And you had a nice manner, a nice presentation. People loved to hear you. In fact, everybody or most of the young people in Spokane were listening to your programs. Many of them were, weren't they?
Very true. It happened to be quite ironic that I was going up against the person who had taught me how to be a DJ. He was on the other side of the frequency with his own night show. When I was recruited to work for the competition, I was head-to-head against him, and he had the number one night show for many years. I looked up to him. I listened. I even called into his show to request songs because I was so enamored by the personality, just the fact that he was a DJ. And I listened to him, and I took the best of him and added a little of myself into it, and ended up becoming pretty well known right up alongside of him. And then the competition bought me out, and I was left on the streets.
Well, now, Chris, the thing is, how old were you? I mean, here you're just, what are you, 18 or 19 years old, and you've almost reached the pinnacle of success?
Yeah, it was very fortunate. I was very, very lucky. And if I could go back and do it again, I wish I could have been a little older and wiser.
And, of course, what happened was you were doing such a good job that the other radio station, which was a music station, bought out your station just to get rid of you.
Correct. Well, I think a lot of it had to do with if you can't beat them, join them. And so they just started fresh, and the very first person on their list to axe off the payroll was yours truly. And it did a number on me. It really did. I had to rely on the other means of DJing, which was a little more of a dirtier environment, to say the least, nightclubs and especially raves. And that was the only way I was able to survive. And that's where I made, I think, the majority of my mistakes was in that scene.
Well, of course, you tell at one point when you're first beginning to try to figure out what you want to do with your life, you have this almost metaphysical experience. And a voice is telling you to go for this. A voice is telling you to get involved in this music and, you know, to throw yourself into it. Would you like to share that? Because this was really sort of almost a defining, or at least one of the early defining points, that you had this feeling that that it was God that was telling you to go ahead and get and proceed.
When people pick up my book, I don't think they expect the spiritual dimension to be covered in this book. And it actually goes into extensive detail as to messages that were given to me. The first night after that rave, I stayed awake as long as I could just to kind of reflect and put myself into place. I wanted to see who I could become. That event had moved me so much that I just wanted some time away, and so I went to my favorite spot in my Park Riverfront Park in Spokane, Washington, very well-known place, and I would just sit there and listen to voices. And at first, they were numerous voices. Then it kind of just narrowed down to one in particular, one that would listen to me, one that would kind of fill my sentences if I didn't finish them. And it felt as if it was like a brother, maybe even a father, you know, just kind of there by my side. It was so difficult to identify. I knew it wasn't a bad spirit, but there was something inspiring about this that kind of pushed me towards making the decision of becoming a DJ. And I think that I'm put into a position like this because there's a higher calling of some nature asking me to become something a little more than just an announcer and a turntable disc jockey.
Well, of course, you'd been raised in a Christian home. You had gone to church. But you never really would consider yourself a Christian, would you, at that point in your life?
At that point, I was... Another strange twist of irony was the morning after that rave, I stepped out onto the streets and I looked across the street to see that some of the people were filing into a church. And I thought to myself, you know, I've been to church numerous times with my mom. I learned about God, but I don't think I, at that point, had seen what God was about until I attended that event. I thought that there was a higher sense of spirituality in the rave scene. I truly felt that was a message that was being given to me at that time. But I later learned that there is spirituality in music, but it's not necessarily the voice of God. And it took me a long time to decipher what is a distracting message and what is a divine message.
Amen to that. Well, basically, after you have reached the pinnacle of success, and how old were you when you finally got fired?
About 19.
19, and here you are, 19 years old. You've suddenly gotten to the height of popularity. Everybody, of course, knows who Dookie is, and that was your sort of your name that you went by. You're famous. Women are sort of calling you all the time. It's really sort of exciting, to be so popular and so well known. And then suddenly you get fired, and now you have no outlet at all. You're an ex-disc jockey, and you've got to go start doing these rave dances. But of course, you're going to have some difficulty because you have to have proper permits, and really you don't have the proper permits. So you're really skirting the law at all times, aren't you?
Raves were illegal. Sometimes they are still. It depends on where you go, but many cities have cracked down. Spokane, for example, only gave us just a few outlets for a couple of months. You know, they let promoters come into places like Masonic temples or old rundown churches and let us do these events, but the kids took advantage of it, and the cops said no more. And they pulled away from it. They kept a distance and monitored the promoters. They wanted to know everything about them, but some of these promoters, especially myself, we would dodge authority because some of the venues wouldn't be up to code. Some of them wouldn't have proper fire exits or water, for that matter, proper bathrooms. You know, we would literally have to go into the dark alleyways, sometimes even under the streets. We'd pull up metal grates on the concrete and go down to these large sewers and basements. And it was the only choice we had because there were no more venues available. The cops had, tipped off every owner that had a building and said, just be aware, here's the signs, here's what to look out for. And so we just had to do it behind their back the entire time.
And, of course, the thing is that they were concerned about there might be drugs, they were concerned about there might be a fire and that kids wouldn't get out, or there'd be some sort of emergency and there'd be a stampede and somebody would be hurt. Do you think that police were justified in being concerned about, especially because sometimes these were so overcrowded, way beyond the number of young people that should have been in a building?
Well, looking at it now, without question, I believe that I did make a huge mistake, and they were right from the very beginning. It's as if authority takes place of your parental units when you move out on your own. They're kind of the voice that says, here's what you should do and here's what you shouldn't do, and you can choose to abide by it, or you can choose to skirt away from any right doings, and ultimately you're going to pay the price. I think there's going to be serious retribution and punishment along with it if you decide to go against their means.
Of course, now you have a character here, and is this a true character? His name is Conrad. He's a police sergeant, and he's sort of looking over your shoulder all the time, and in some ways, respects, actually protecting you, when many times you should have been arrested and he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. There's a character in the book that is a composite of many characters in my life. In fact, one of the very first things in the book mentions that a lot of the situations, places, and characters have been combined only because over the course of my existence in the disc jockey industry, I've met so many colorful characters, but I had to narrow them down. And so Officer Conrad was a mixture of a lifelong family friend and a person of high authority in the Spokane City Police Department. So there was a police officer. In the real life, there was a gentleman who was making it difficult to get permits to promoters, any kind of promoter, Christian rock promoters, rave promoters, rock promoters. This man had a very difficult time bending over backwards to helping get any kind of music entertainment in the Spokane city limits. He was the man that I had many discussions with at music roundtables. We would talk to him at city council meetings. A local newspaper would help us, break the ice a little bit to get issues brought up to where people would question authority. And ultimately, after everything was said and done, many years after the meat of the book, I ended up working hand in hand with the officer to open up legal venues, because no matter what, promoters are going to do it. They're going to go behind a person's back. But if the police offer assistance to make the venues legal, to make there be proper bathrooms and water and breathing room, it's going to make for a safer environment for everyone involved.
All right, fine. So then you start putting on these rave programs, and some of these are really pretty wild as far as the music is concerned, aren't they?
I guess not. It really depends on your definition of wild, because I believe that techno music is probably the safest style of music out there, because generally it is instrumental. There are no lyrics that can offend. You kind of build your own story around it. You can take a track from a party that you heard and drop it into your CD player and actually be able to identify with it in your own way. You can create your own lyrics, your own situation to identify with the song. I think it's probably safer than most hardcore rap or rock groups.
All right, fine. So that's primarily then what you were playing at these programs.
Correct.
All right, fine. And so then, of course, as the story progresses, you're not taking drugs at all, but there's a tendency on the part of some of the people you're working with, they're on what, methamphetamine?
Correct, correct. Many of the people in my generation and the rave scene were highly attracted to crystal meth more than anything.
All right, and of course, this gives you a tremendous rush, a tremendous stimulation, doesn't it?
There's something about it that just opens up your circuits to where you can stay awake for days.
Now, is Eddie, there's a character, there's Eddie, as he's your closest friend. Is he a real individual?
He is. There's a character of mine throughout the entire book that's alongside of me that is experiencing everything I experienced. The only difference is he was the walking pharmacy of the bunch. He wanted to experiment with anything that came his way, and there would be times where he would just dose himself up so much where he'd get into serious situations of a depression. And towards the end of the book, he is contemplating suicide. And there's a major difference in the book itself. I really don't want to give away the ending, but I feel it's justified to say that the character alongside of me, my best friend Eddie, died in the book. Now, in real life, he died for 2 minutes. He came. He overdosed at a rave one time. I took him back to my house. It was at that moment that I had decided that if I was going to continue to go down the same path he was going, I would be on the couch with him. I would overdose. I soon would die myself. I looked in the mirror and I realized that's not who I wanted to become. The real situation that had happened is identical to that. The only difference is, in the book, he dies to give a very powerful message across the people that this can happen to you. I was fortunate to have a friend who crossed the threshold just for a few minutes and was able to come back and share his message, and that was the defining point. To elaborate a little bit more, towards the end, I too started to get into the drugs myself, and I was right alongside of him. I chose crystal meth too for a very brief amount of time, and that was the biggest mistake I had ever made.
Well, of course, it's so easy to do, and you know, somebody offers it to you, or maybe you don't even know you're taking it, but boy, once you get that feeling, it must be electrifying.
It was difficult for me to justify at first. I would have promoters around me saying, you know, you're a one in a million person. You are the man who holds events. You are the party guy. You have to be on point. You've got to be, running on all cylinders at all times. You know, you're the very first person to show up, and you're the last person to leave at these events. Stay on point, to be alert, and use this as a tool. Well, it seemed like a pretty good excuse to me, so I started doing that, but it turned out to be more than just a weekend thing. It was a every so often thing, then it was a every other day thing, and then it was an everyday thing, and it just was a constant cycle downward, and at that point, I never got to the point where I was really all that depressed, but watching it come out of Eddie was a true eye-opening experience for me, and I'm just glad that I didn't experience that pain like he did.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest this evening is Aaron Traylor. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Aaron Traylor. His book is A Life Remixed. And, of course, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.